May it please the court, Tom Carberry, number 19707, appearing for Mr. Sartain. We have a lot of complex issues in this case, but I think they come down to a question of what do interrogatories and verdict forms mean, and what is the statute of limitations, and how do you find somebody guilty of an indeterminate sentence? And I think one of the most important things that this court could clarify for criminal defense attorneys is, in verdict forms, does this caption have any meaning? The jury's not required to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the caption has any meaning whatsoever. Whereas in the interrogatory, they have to find beyond a reasonable doubt and unanimously that a certain thing happened. For instance, it occurred in a pattern of abuse where it occurred after November 1, 1998.
Mr. Carver, could I ask you on this verdict form question, and I just don't remember, did the court go through the verdict form with the jury when it kind of it gives the instructions, and sometimes the court will go, ladies and gentlemen, you're going to get a verdict form and walk through it. I know that the prosecutor argued about the verdict form. I just don't remember if the court said anything about it.
The court really didn't. The court did. I quoted it in my reply brief to some extent. They did point out, like, jury instruction one, verdict form number one to them, but not in general. The court never told the jurors, you have to find that R.A.B. was 16 to 17 years old, or any of these things. The court just didn't tell them that these have to be separate incidents, you know, the touching in the bath or the rubbing in the bath. Those, you know, there are no interrogatories saying that those had to be separate. That's exactly what Wolhoff and Quintano cases are about. In Wolhoff, the court reversed because there were interrogatories. They didn't have interrogatories, they just had these verdict forms for captions. And in Quintano, they upheld the defendant's convictions because they had interrogatories where the jurors had to sign it. I think that's just a very crucial issue in this case.
On the counts 19 through 24, on the incest charges, did the jury have to make a determination about how old the victim was on particular dates, or just have to make a determination that the victim was under 21?
Well, they didn't have to make any determinations about dates at all, but they were told that it could be on or about the date of the place crime charge, which goes to when she's over 21. And then in the elemental instructions, it said, and the victim was under 21, but then in the verdict form, it doesn't deal with it at all.
Except in the caption where it says 15 to 16.
Exactly, except in the caption, exactly.
Okay. So what, basically, our job is to decide what's the effect of that one.
Yes, and your job is to decide, do you have to have an interrogatory? Does the jury have to say, we unanimously find this? Because under Apprendi, the jury has to make the findings. And under Apprendi, in my view, that caption is a judicial fact-finding or a DA fact-finding, because they write the instructions. The jury fact-finding is when they come back and they have an options. You know, we find that this occurred after November 1st, 1998, or we find that this occurred before June 6, 2002. You know, those are the types of options that they... But here, we only have... The only interrogatories that we have of that kind are in 26, 27, 28, and 29 that say these events occurred after November 1st, 1998. And, of course, that doesn't cure the problem with 19 through 24.
Mr. Carver, I recognize that you're asking for, you know, or you started by suggesting maybe there could be some guidance on how you make this, you know, kind of election. And I guess you're suggesting that it would need to be an interrogatory, but let me just float another possibility to get your reaction. I mean, one could read the verdict form, recognize we have to assume if the caption's okay, that the government made either constructive amendment here or made an election. And there's no prejudice to the defendant, arguably, because the election with, or the constructive amendment is less than what was charged. That would be another way to get at the problem, short of doing an interrogatory. I mean, they could make an election or could amend the charge, couldn't they?
But only, they could amend the charge. They definitely could do that, as long as it's not to substance. But the problem, Judge Gabriel, is that there's nothing in the verdict forms that makes the jury decide that we're even reading that caption. You know, the verdict form just says, we find the defendant guilty of aggravated incest. And there's no interrogatory to go along with that. You know, at what age? And, you know, here we have a statute that requires, you know, 18-6-302 requires that the child be under the age of 21.
But it does explain the count, right? It's, I mean, I'm looking at half and half count 19 here. It says count 19, you know, RA under 15 to 16. Could not one argue that that was, whether it's an amendment to the charge or an election or something, it's telling the jury that count 19 involves, you know, when the child was 15 to 16.
Yes, but the court never explained that to the jury. And also in Woolhaff, which is a very important case for us, that's the exact same thing that happened in Woolhaff. And although the issue is slightly different, it's one of our issues here. In Woolhaff was the unit of prosecution. The outcome is the same. In Woolhaff, there was no interrogatory, just this caption. And the Supreme Court said that's not good enough. But in Quintana, which came out the same day as Woolhoff, they did have interrogatories as opposed to these captions in the verdict form, and they affirmed.
Could I back us off the verdict form captions for just a moment? You referenced Apprendi, and that calls to mind an argument that the Attorney General made that I didn't see addressed in your reply brief, namely that to the extent these are 35C claims, that they were successive because it could have been raised on direct appeal.
And just both, I meant to address that at the beginning, but the reality here is there's no 35C ever at this point. Because what happened was in 07 CR 883, this court reversed the sentence and remanded for a new sentencing hearing. When the court did that, there was no conviction at that point. Legally under Rule 32. So you can't have a 35C. All that happened when we went back down was we had pre-sentence motions filed. That's all it was. There was no sentencing. 35C can only happen after a sentence has been imposed, within 3 years of the date of the sentence. That's specifically what 16.5402 says about 35Cs. And since there was no sentence, there couldn't be a 35C hearing.
Well, to call these pre-sentence motions, and yet you're raising constitutional arguments like Apprendi violations and, you know, double jeopardy and whatnot, isn't that a little bit beyond the scope of what one would think of as pre-sentence motions?
No, Judge Bowden, that's what good lawyers do. Unfortunately, what happened in this case was the trial lawyer, Mr. Truman, did nothing. He filed zero motions in the entire case.
Mr. Truman was ineffective?
I think he's just one of the worst trial lawyers I've ever seen. He didn't care. He didn't file any, not even one motion. Well, I can take that back. He filed a motion to reduce bond. Okay? This is exactly what a lawyer needed to do before sentencing, because in sentencing, you go to sentence on all the counts that the jury found you guilty of. So before sentencing, you want to raise all the constitutional issues against these counts that were found. You know, under Cagle, People Against Cagle, Colorado Supreme Court case, you can file constitutional issues up to the date of sentence.
What is Cagle,
C-A-G-L-E. C-A-G-L-E-G-A-L-E. And that's what I did here. We filed these motions up to sentencing because they needed to be filed. Now, these are real legal issues, not 35C issues. 35C issues would be ineffective issues coming back. And that goes to the same with issue number two on the interrogatories. There was an interrogatory issued in these counts, on four of them at least, saying that it happened after November 1st, 98, but nothing saying that it happened before June 6th, 2002. And see, it's obviously the court knew about interrogatories, and it's obviously the court read Quintana because the court had actually quoted it at the jury instruction conference. So the court knew that they needed to have interrogatories, and knew that the Supreme Court in Woolhoff had said the captions weren't sufficient. And so,
was there any? What's the state of the record in terms of whether there was any argument that these verdict forms were insufficient, and if there wasn't, what is the effect, if any, on preservation?
Well, there's two different. There was no preservation in the 07 CR, CA 883, in the first appeal. Because Mr. Truman didn't object to anything. There wasn't any preservation. But even despite that, in the opinion that this court issued, this court reversed on counts 9 through 14 and remanded for new sentencing because there was no interrogatory on when the pattern counts occurred, which is exactly what happens, what I'm arguing here. The pattern count went into effect July 1st, 1998, and there was no interrogatory saying that these acts happened after July 1st, 1998, and so this court reversed, saying it could not be indeterminate sentences.
And what about 19 to 24? Was there any argument that the verdict forms were incorrect?
No, there was no argument, but there was argument on all those issues before the sentencing on the remand. And so it's everything's preserved.
Okay.
Everything's preserved. And, you know, because under People Against Sharp, 155 P3rd, 577, which is a court of appeals case from 2006, that there the court held that when you get your sentence vacated and remanded, that you have everything starts over again. And in Sharp, what happened was he was convicted before Crawford, then on appeal, it got reversed, went back down for sentencing. He got resentenced 4 days after the sentencing. Crawford came out, so he raised Crawford on appeal and won. Okay, and that's what happened. What happened here. This court vacated the conviction, it remanded, and that was the sentence. And I see that I'm almost out of time, and I'd like to reserve a few more minutes I have left, if I may.
Sure, you've got about 3 minutes and 40 seconds left.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman, attorney registration number 17846. And I represent the people in this matter. I just wanted to thank the court for rescheduling. Welcome to Mr. Carberry accommodating my schedule. I really appreciate that. I want to just sort of give a brief introduction about sort of factors that are involved in the variety of instructional issues in this case. One of the ones that we all know, that we presume that the jury followed the instructions, and that we consider the instructions as a whole. I think in cases where we're dealing with multiple offenses and trying to determine whether there was sufficient clarity for the jury to make unanimous verdicts about various counts, there are a number of factors we consider. We consider, first of all, in a very simple case, whether any additional instructions are needed. For example, a case where you have two separate acts of assault, and there are two verdict forms, and it's really clear there isn't any necessity at all to distinguish those in a way. The jury will not become confused by that. In more complex cases, and one we have here, we look at things like whether we specify the acts in the verdict form, and I, of course, we'll be coming to that in detail here. Whether we use special interrogatories to determine either dates of events or specific acts like enhancers, like position of trust or pattern enhancers, and special unanimity instructions like the Quintana instruction. And then we also look at things like, when we're talking about ambiguity, is whether there are issues in dispute. And as I said way too many times in my brief, in this case, Mr. Truman repeatedly told the jury, we are not disputing any of these acts except for one, when the victim was 16, that they took place, or the age of the victim. The only thing we're disputing here is whether these were for a sexual purpose.
But he couldn't waive. I mean, if there's a statute of limitations issue here, and they were convicting this person for acts committed before the statute began, right? He couldn't waive that by saying
not. That's true. Statute of limitations, he could not waive. And then I think whether the arguments are clarified by the parties and or the court, and in this situation, the prosecutor clarified in closing argument that if you look at the verdict forms, I'll give you an example. Count one, it states the age, and that's the date period for this particular count, and I'm paraphrasing, of course. And then I would actually disagree with Mr. Carberry. I think the judge actually did instruct the jury that if you look at the particular count, the verdict form, that it includes the allegation pertaining to each count. And he goes through one and he says, count one, RA, 12 to 14 years old, breast touch, height and bath. So the court goes out of its way, the prosecutor goes out of the way to say this, and I think those are really issues about selecting particular acts. Mr. Carberry is arguing essentially that there are specific elements that the age of the victim at a given moment in time, or the specific date of the offense is somehow an element of the offense, but really what we're dealing with here are the efforts to clarify which particular acts go with which particular count. I think we have direction from both the Court of Appeals and from the Supreme Court as to the validity of including a victim's age, the location of an act, or the nature of the act, from both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. In People versus Greer, and I think the language I remember using was the court noted with apparent approval that saying the act that took place in the freezer was sufficient to identify the act that went with that. The court is really addressing, I think, three other or five other counts, but it notes that one off separately. But in People versus Simon out of the Supreme Court, the court's more clear about this. This is a case that involves two defendants, came up together, Simon and Tillery, and asked Mr. Tillery, the court notes early on, that the court, the verdict form specified the acts, that is, oral sex in the garage, sexual contact in the bedroom after the garage. And so you can see by those, it described the conduct, the location, even the time frame for the acts. And the court, in upholding that there were five separate assault pattern counts, noted that they were identified each as specific incidents of sexual assault within the verdict form itself. So I think we have the answer to that. From both this court and the Supreme Court.
Mr. Holman, if I can interrupt you, I would appreciate, I'm going to jump ahead on you. Would you address the successiveness issue? Mr. Carberry's argument that this wasn't a 35C, therefore the successive rules don't apply. I confess that it had not occurred to me until he said that.
I of course think that they do apply. I think this has to be a post-conviction motion. I would just say, and it's merely a technicality maybe, but the court here actually completes the sentencing and then turns to these motions afterwards, so they're not occurring prior to sentencing in a time sense. But what happened on appeal was not that the this court vacated the convictions. All the court did was find that under the instructions that were given, the enhancers couldn't apply to, I think it's counts 9 through 14, so there wasn't a vacating of the convictions, and all we're going back is to re-sentence on those counts without the enhancer, and that's exactly what the court does. There isn't any large re-sentencing. So the convictions are in place. I don't think that you could take it, essentially what you would have to be arguing is you can take a direct appeal every time one sentence is changed on direct appeal, that you can bring a whole lot on challenging the convictions themselves. It seems to me that mechanism isn't available, and that what we're reading is 35C.
Mr. Carberry referenced Cagle for the proposition that one can raise constitutional issues up to the time of sentencing. Do you know that case?
I do not know the facts. I will be going back to read that case right after this. So without my, I just have to disagree with that. I think what we are is in the 35C setting. These claims actually sound a lot like the one that was reversed on direct appeal. It seems like appropriate direct appeal, but as I think the court is familiar with, in 2004, Rule 35C was changed. Before that, it said the trial court may deny a motion as a second motion or successive motion, and in 2004 that rule was changed to clarify the court shall deny a motion as successive. And I think the court here said that they thought it might be a 35A. I know Mr. Carberry argued that he thought it was there under this other argument. I think with due respect, all of them, they're mistaken that this is really a 35C motion.
Mr. Holman, before I just want to run out of time here, can I ask you on this wall half issue for a minute? I understand that your position here is that instruction 20 kind of solved the problem and Quintano supports your position. I guess I understand your argument to a point. We have an instruction that says you gotta find separate acts. Well, in a couple of them, just by way of example, we have massage, breast touch, massage, butt touch, or whatever it was. How do we know they're different incidents? I mean, Wolhoff would say it has to be a different, incident. Like you could have touched within a millisecond, a breast and the behind, and that would seem to me that's one unit of prosecution under Wolhoff. Why does the instruction solve that problem? I get that the jury had to find the breast touch was different than the other touch, but what happened? How did the jury decide it was different incidents? It wasn't the same moment in time.
Well, I think what Kim and I may just be repeating what I've already said in brief, which I think is the same answer, which is what Quintana says is when you instruct the jury that they had to find the same act for each count, that the reading of that a reasonable juror would have understood that there has to be a separate act for each count.
Sure, but a separate act could be, touching somebody's breast is different than touching a different part of the body, but that doesn't mean that it would be a different incident for Wolhoff purposes.
Well,
there's no time for reflection in between. There wasn't a go away and come back. You could have, yes, they're different. I touched this part of your body, I touched this part of your body, and I did it within 1 second of each other as part of the same thing. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do, Your Honor. I guess my answer to that would be that one is we look at the common meaning of act, which is, well, as lawyers, we think of acts involving several incidents or something like that. I think of those as individual actus reus, for example. I think a juror's common understanding of this would be that an act is an event in itself. I think the prosecutor with the witnesses tried to carefully go through the separate acts as well as they could and then specify time periods for them, and that there were several occasions, I think one of them said, I'm just recalling, I think more than 50 acts perhaps. I think, again, perhaps what Quintana says is just the jury's going to understand that these involve separate acts, which I would say is an event itself. And again, Mr. Truman again didn't dispute any of these as not occurring or when they occurred or the age of the victim when they took place. And so I think the instruction here satisfies that. And I think that's the, again, going back again, Quintana says at the core of this, a reasonable juror would understand that they have to involve several acts. And I don't think there was, I don't recall arguments specifically to that point that you can convict if you touched her seven times in the bathtub, those count as seven separate convictions. I think it was a real effort to set these out over a long time period in the timeline.
Mentioned something that related to Judge Loeb's question about plain error. I know in your brief you've talked a few times about how trial counsel's failure to raise this or request more specificity would somehow suggest that if it was error, it would have to be reviewable under plain error. Perhaps I'm putting words in your mouth.
Unlikely so far, so.
Okay. To what extent does counsel's failure to take further steps as to some of these issues that Mr. Cartwright raises, how does that affect our assessment of the defendant's right to relief on these issues? Let's say it's the first one about the statute of limitations. Are we in a position to say, well, they were close enough, since the trial court didn't or the trial counsel didn't ask for more specificity in the verdict forms, is it too late to do that now?
I think that's right. I guess I'm going to step back one step and just say that the claim here is not that the charges violate the statute of limitations. The claim is that the jury instructions allowed the jury to find the defendant guilty of acts that occurred that would have been outside of the statute of limitations. So I think those are different because I think a true statute of limitations charging claim may be subject to just a de novo review, an actual lack of jurisdiction over the case statute of limitations claim. I think the instructional issue, both from a review standpoint, both involves this what would be at a minimum plain error, but also some constitutional dimension under Rule 35C. From a pragmatic point of view, I think it makes clear it's sort of like not objecting during closing argument that we presume that it didn't seem as horrible as a claim on appeal at the moment, and when we look at the situation there where the attorneys are there and he's not thinking there's a problem with these, I would say that indication from a practical point of view that the defense thought these were adequate, and I think that's generally the overall sort of tenor of the situation.
So let me just ask another quick question about 19 to 24 again. They have these, they all say, except for 19, they say the curve when the victim was 15 to 16. 19 actually says under 15.
And 16.
Right, which means younger than 15 in my mind. As to all of those, are we essentially what you're saying is we should assume the jury understood those as saying, okay, these acts, this particular act and this count took place, take 19 for example, before the victim was 15 years old. We can assume that. Is that what the verdict form is telling the jury? And then all the jury form has to find is, did the defendant do it?
I think the verdict forms are telling the jury the time period based on the age of the victim as to when the events occurred.
In that particular count.
In that particular count. And I think also, again, I realize I'm just going back to there, there wasn't any dispute about those things at all. Those things were never disputed. It wasn't one of those things failed to dispute. You know, defense counsel again got up and said that I don't dispute any of that.
So how does 19 survive the statute of limitations here? That this act could have been, from the jury standpoint, as far as the jury knows, it could be any time when the victim here was under 15, which could well have been a period outside the statute of limitations. We don't know. We don't have anything more specific than under 15.
That's correct, John. I would start by saying that one is that has not been raised as an issue here, that the under 15 somehow undermined that instruction. I think that was a typographical error. My recollection is that the defense counsel or the prosecutor carefully went through the time frames. There were 15 to 16. There were either 17 to something. And there was never this claim.
Well, but with respect, I don't think you can have it both ways. You tell us to look at the caption on the form. This caption says under 15 to 16. I think we have to presume the jury followed that.
Well, presuming that the jury followed, again, Mr. Carver hasn't raised that as an issue here, so I would argue that it's not before the court.
Well, it says they all violate the statute of limitations, so I'm not, but, with respect, I'm not sure that's right.
But I would argue that it would be harmless error, given one, the defense counsel's position, and the clock is running up now. I'm sorry, I'm out of time.
You're over your time.
But this has gotten me wrong. So,
thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your time.
Mr. Carberry, you've got some 3 minutes and 40 seconds.
Thank you. May it please the court. Cagle is 751 P second 614. When Mr. Holman was giving an example of the jury, what Wolhoff type jury's instructions, he said in the garage and then after garage. But we don't have any distinguishing words like after in this case. We just have bathtub touching or whatever. That's all we have. There's nothing to distinguish them. And I want to go back to the 35C issue because Judge Gabriel raised it. You can't have a 35C unless you have a conviction. You can't have a conviction unless you have a sentence. Rule 32B says that a judgment of conviction shall consist of the guilty plea or the verdict and the sentence. So you can't have a 35C at all in this situation. Then as far as we can, Judge Loeb, you said we can assume in 19 to 24 that the jury read those the caption. That's actually something I think the court really needs to clarify here. I don't think we can assume anything that the jury doesn't sign. We can assume an interrogatory, but the court instructs the jury. We, the jury, unanimously find beyond a reasonable doubt that X happened or that X didn't happen, and we sign that. But not just to have something that the judge writes up in the caption. to control what's going on here, because that the captain is just something that the courts and the DA sort of made up here. Because that issue comes right down to Apprendi and the need for a jury to make a finding. And without an interrogatory, how do we know what the jury found?
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Carberry, what if I'm looking at 19, just happened out in front of me. What if the verdict form said, instead of having it in the caption, we the jury find the defendant guilty of aggravated incest as charged in count 19 in which the victim was 15 to 16?
Yes.
Now, so, but what's the difference? I mean, the four-person signed the very same form, it's just, it would have been two lines lower.
Well, the big difference is because the instruction tells them, this is what we found. It doesn't say anything about the caption. And just as Judge Lowe pointed out, that 19 is under 15 to 16, something that I didn't realize until oral argument, because I had been reading all of these the same, as being 15 to 16, you know. That's not, you know, the jury didn't focus on it. The jury focuses on what they have to sign. And that's the issue. They focus on the jury instruction and what they have to sign, but they didn't have to sign off on this 15 to 16 or any of these other ages. That's the real problem here.
But I guess my concern is, did the jury, as an elemental matter, have to actually make a finding of fact about how old the victim was as to any of these counts? I mean,
of course, I don't think so.
So what does it matter then?
Well, I mean, it matters. It does matter the jury instruction did say that the victim was under 21.
I understand. Nobody's disputing.
Nobody's disputing it. But they didn't have to make the finding. And the problem is, just as in the original Sartain opinion, where they could have, some of the acts could have happened after the date, or in this case, in the original Sartain opinion, it was a pattern instruction, the pattern didn't come into effect until July 1st, 1998, but you had acts before it and acts after it. So they reversed and said, we can't have the pattern for 9 through 14. That's the same issue here. You can't have this incest if the girl was over 21. And there was never, and it was charged where she was over 21. It was charged until 2003, and she was turned 21 in 2002. That's the problem. And I'd ask the court to reverse. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carberry. Thank you to both counsel again for your flexibility in scheduling, for your very helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course. This was